Okay. Hi everyone, welcome to the session, Sounds and Silences, Audio Text and Disability in Queer and Trans Collections. I'm your chair for this afternoon. I'm very happy to be here with these speakers talking about this issue. I'm the president of the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives, so it is an issue that is particular also to any archive, I think, so I'm really excited to be here. We're going to hear from four speakers. Eva Ishakson will be first, Apo Radowski and Yamina Lindholm, and Stephen Dryden. So we're going to go in the order that they are in the program, and after everyone has finished their presentations, we will have time for discussion and questions. So I'd like to welcome Eva. Eva works at the Helsinki University Library. She was a board member at the Finnish SETA Organisation for Sexual Equality, chief editor of SETA magazine, a SETA representative at the IGA conference, and responsible for running the International Lesbian Information Secretariat in 1982 to 1984. She started the first SETA web pages in 1994 and started a list for Finnish lesbians in 1993 and for European lesbians in 1994. Welcome, Eva.
Okay, first, I hope you can understand me, my English, because I am very hard of hearing and I did not talk and spoken English before I got cochlear implant some years ago. Okay. I will first tell you about myself. How I become a violent lesbian activist. And next, I will talk about the materials that I have because of this. They are conversation books and mailing list archives. First, some personal history. First, it is a happy little girl with mum. And next year, there was a worldwide influenza pandemic. I lost practically all of my hearing. And next picture, you can see I am not smiling anymore. So, when I was 4 years old, I learned to read. And reading and writing became my lifeline. And I am pretty sure some of you will ask, what about sign language? And what about deaf community? In my family, no one was signed. And I never have learned to sign. Hard of hearing people, if they do not sign, they are very much in the margin. They are in the margin of the hearing community. And the real challenge they have is only not to hear and to communicate, but more it is to be heard. But very few people seem to know about this. It is about communication. Gay men said to me once that hard of hearing people, they are lucky. They are not like the other cripples. They can have sex. So I finally entered the gay and lesbian community with Ben and Baby. I like conversations with others by writing. Next, I started to write for magazines, and I became a magazine editor, and next, an international activist. Here are a part of my notebooks. I have a box full of them. Some of them are very big. But who were the people who were writing then? The first one was my roommate in the 70s. She was a lesbian activist and wanted to become a writer, and she needed a reader. I learned a lot about gay and lesbian history in Finland from her. Then other people, first in Helsinki, then in Stockholm, then all over Europe and United States. The numbers grew as I traveled to conferences. I also stayed in East Germany for my studies and met East German lesbians. And I have conversation books from that time. Here's a glimpse of my books. They are in Finnish, Swedish, English, German. And it is easy to see this is interesting historical material. Mm-hmm. It would not exist if I was not hard of hearing. Mm-hmm. But what will I do with these books? There are lots of problems. First, who are all these people I had conversation with? I recognize the handwriting in some cases, but most are unknown. Sometimes I know the year, the country, the conference, and sometimes not. These are not diaries and they are not letters. No permissions were asked. People were, of course, asking, what will I do with these books? Will I be reading them later? I said that no. And to tell you the truth, I am not reading them. They are too embarrassing. I was young. It is a lot of stupid conversations. And sometimes we were drunk. And to give them to an archive would be difficult, as archives do not have this kind of material. I have been told, just send everything to us. I got seen as an older person. I could be gone very soon. And what will happen to everything? But I cannot give them up yet. So last autumn, I got a big professional scanner and started a scanning project. I plan to scan all these books, but it can take a long time. I so far have scanned only 4 books. Here is a base of conversation in East Germany. the next phase in my life. It is very exhausting to be hard of hearing. It is not easy to be an activist. So I had a burnout and dropped out from the activist work. But after some years, there was the internet, and it really was something different. It does not matter if you are hard of hearing. You can hear everything. I walk it on and I communicate with everyone. Here I am getting my first computer. And only a few years I was handling two big mailing lists for lesbians. Sacrilist. It was very important in Finland. There were lots of Finnish women on that list. And then there was an European list. And both lists had hundreds of people, and the archives are big. What are over tens of thousands messages? That is a lot. And this is the next problem. What will I do with these messages? I was having a list on my own server. I was a Linux nerd, and I still am. But I asked people, what will they want with their own stories? I asked this on Facebook because the lists are not no more running. Someone told me that the list had been a support. She was a young lesbian, rejected by her parents, and she found the list and others she would communicate with. And now, 25 years later, her life situation is different. And the work and family situation have changed. She is worried about confidentiality. At the same time, she would love to have the sort of old text with a researcher. But it is difficult. She wants her name withheld. Main problem is the confidentiality. The very personal information and there are lots of metadata. The names, the personal information are not only in the headers, but it is in lots of water text. And there are no set rules for this material. Archives do not know what to do with it. Where are the list archives? I have them. There exists list archive software, and I have processes, sub-list archive with it. It is easy to archive at search. But I have not searched it with an archive because of the problems. Your software is still online, and there is an online archive that a subscriber can access. And I am only a part of the problem. Und ein verstandener Licht und Licht wie ein Licht. I collected all this info. And there was an enormous amount of list. But where are all these messages now? No one knows. No one has done any work to archive them. I will finish with the present. The mailing lists are practically stopped. Some backups of archives can be out there. And usually many lists were owned by lesbian and gay and trans people themselves. But it is now unclear who owns this material. As for myself, as a hard of hearing person, I see a tend towards away from text and more towards sound and video that is not accessible. Where will I communicate next? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eva, for that fantastic presentation. I'd like to invite Apo and Yomine up to do their presentation next, asking questions and refusing answers, queer crypt guided tours in the Finnish Museum of Photography.
Okay, I'll give a little introduction to Apo and Yomine are contemporary artists and art pedagogists based in Helsinki, Finland. Both artists are part of the FAQ Feminism and Queer in Art Education Research Collective and host Queer Crypt guided tours in the Finnish Museum of Photography. Welcome.
Thank you.
We may have a bit of problem with the internet connection.
Now.
Does someone know
German? What should we do?
Great, thanks.
It should be quite smart. But you just want to access the internet?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is it. So we just do one press, like, play, so to go.
Yes, maybe that is online.
Was this the internet window that you have open?
Yeah. This is the Chrome.
Yeah, okay, I see.
But the connection is offline at the moment.
Yeah, okay.
Or something. So maybe if you take it off and then you can
yeah.
Somehow.
Let's see.
But they have problems with the panel before. It's just the connection.
Oh, the connection is bad.
Yeah, That's
mm-hmm. Sometimes works and sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, we should have
no, it works.
No? Really?
Yeah, I think the tick went off.
You can go to because I made it full screen.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So if you go.
So this is.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the introduction.
Thank you.
Dear living beings, all those who will come after us, and all those who came before, we are honored to be here and share our processes with all of you. We are art education students in Aalto University in Finland, and we worked together as freelance guides and workshop hosts in Finnish Museum of Photography in Helsinki.
I forgot to say that we have access copies, if somebody needs one, with 15 PT. They're here, you should have them. Sorry for interrupting.
No.
Okay. So I'm Yomine, and I'm an artist and an art educator. And my main field of interest in the intersection of contemporary art, sickness, and the critical disability studies.
And I'm Aapo. I'm an artist, art educator, and philosopher, and my interests combine art education with analytical ethics, gender studies, queer feminism, posthumanism, and performance art.
The following is a short essay text on the case of queer plus creep guided tours, pondering around the following questions. How to mediate queer and creep issues in the museum? How to employ practices of feminist pedagogies and strategies and ideology of safer spaces in the museum context? How do queer, creep and posthumanists work side by side or in relation to each other in discussing art choreography and togetherness? Why concentrate on multiple perspectives? How is it possible to resist and challenge a normative guiding situation and acknowledge the necessity for uncertainty? How to prepare for the unplanned?
First queer and creep guided tours were initiated as a part of the first Queer History Month held in Finland in fall 2018. We were commissioned to create a public program related to queer and feminism. We had each written an article in a book called Feminism and Queer in Art Education previously last year, and decided to combine our interests and perspectives, queer and creep, for this program.
Our talk will differ from many of the others here in this conference in the sense that we are not the ones that do the actual archiving or immediate work related to collections. We as art educators and pedagogues are the ones who work with the collections once they are exhibited, and the ones who mediate art and are responsible for encountering the visitors in the museum. Our perspectives steer us strongly towards the questions of learning and unlearning, the undeniable power position of the museum institution, and us as guides and art educators requires us to aim at being very conscious and sensitive about our privileges and silences, and reformulate and renegotiate our position whenever possible.
We use the format of a guided tour to occupy a queer and creep space in the museum, where our focus is in dismantling and challenging certain norms and certain normativity by intersecting these two perspectives and approaching their histories and the concept of the other from a posthumanist point of view. Usually we concentrate on deconstructing three norms: the compulsory heterosexuality, compulsory able-bodiedness, and compulsory anthropocentrism. We do queering and creeping regardless of the content of the exhibition or the intent of the artist. With this, we want to emphasize the fact that queer and creep perspectives as such are and have always been present. And while discussing art photography, we can at least try to find them and appropriate the materials hanged on the walls to our own purpose and gaze. Concretely, we do this by doing queer and creep readings of the exhibited works, approaching the works with small gestures like gaze exercises, and facilitating a strictly horizontal platform for discussion. Each guided tour is always different and depends largely on group dynamics.
Our work is informed by our positions as experts by experience, queer theory, feminist pedagogy, and critical disability studies. In practice, we do not have a clear predefined script for the tours that we would follow from certain theory or thinkers, but the guiding situation remains theoretically open and invites different knowledges from all the participants. There is no checklist.
Queer for us has to do with its meaning in strangeness, and thus its normative position as the other when it comes to to gender and sexuality. It is a diverse term within the queer community. When queer perspectives are centralized, they open up possibilities of gazing past the obvious normative meanings in images and social situations, for instance. No gender or sexuality is presupposed, but gender and sexuality are seen as performative realities, contingent and, at the same time, informed or even governed by societal gender norms. Centralizing the queer perspective by admitting the performative aspects of gender and sexuality does not mean that a non-queer person can assume a queer identity without having that connection beforehand on a personal level. In the context of our tours, It is a way of learning how to gaze things in multiple, diverse, and non-normative ways, and simply learning to notice our own ways of gazing and how they intersect with queer potentiality.
Creep is a short for the English word cripple. The term was formerly used as a pejorative for people with disabilities. Along with disability activism in the 60s and 70s, the term was re-owned and repurposed by the people with disabilities and used in a provocative and even in an ironic manner. For us, the contemporary use of the term bases on inclusivity and intersectionality, meaning that it includes all disabilities, varying from physical impairments to chronic illnesses, and considers intersecting identities, meaning nobody is either or, but both and. In other words, the term has been appropriated to reinforce potentiality of disability. Self-determination plays a huge role in it. It resigns from the diagnostic case and the medical model of disability and other words and terms that are assigned from above or outside. The origin and the use of the term can be slightly compared to the similar development of as in the use of the term queer. I want to also highlight that there is no consensus about the use of the term within the community, meaning that different words and terms are needed and necessary in different spaces, locations, and cultures.
The work of queering and creeping involves learning about history and future potential, and perhaps most importantly, unlearning sexism, ableism, anthropocentrism, racism, and classism. In the museum context, we rework these learning processes together with the participants and through the medium of images. We gaze individually and together, and we discuss our gazes. The field of visual culture and how queer and creep people are represented often rely on a tragic narrative. In the guiding situation, we find ourselves balancing the oppressive notion of these histories with queer and creep potentialities. How can we reinforce the future possibilities and simultaneously be conscious of the diverse aspects of our past?
Images and especially photographs often provide a catalyzing surface to reflect upon our own gaze. It is our situated relationship with the other in each particular context, and how the hegemonic gaze has shaped our individual gazes. We recognize as a central pedagogical challenge the crisis that unlearning oppression induces. This crisis calls for a safer learning space, a situation where emotions and relations can be reworked in an empathetic process without the usual defense mechanisms that shelter us when facing the possibility of being in the wrong. Together, we try to learn about our own gazes and about the opportunities of gazing differently. Sometimes the tension is relieved through crying or acknowledging aloud that the tour was the first place where some visitors felt recognized as queer plus creep persons.
As pedagogues, the challenge for us is to provide epistemic justice by focusing on open-endedness. This is often hard, as the uncertainty in a normative guiding situation is often psychologically demanding. Who are the audience? Will they participate? What will they want? What will they not want? In teaching, this uncertainty easily turns into a detailed plan and then a structure that not only dissects the space and time of the learning, but also the cognition of the participants. Open-endedness is mandatory, as no guided tour can succeed in deconstructing all oppressive structures or even recognizing them. Failure is an imminent part of our practice and is itself a queer and creep practice.
The way our feminist practice and pedagogy manifests itself is by making space, meaning social embodied space within the museum between the participants at that specific moment of the guided tour. After the session, that space may continue to grow in ways that we cannot control. The building of that space is subtle, conscious, and training, continuous and draining work, willingness to engage in emotional labor and in taking care of the group, and allowing emotion, movement, confusion, and different modes and levels of participation in a public space. The building of that space starts within us as an experience lived and embodied that continues to grow and to become understood in relation to theory and the experiences of others. The building of that space is active translating theory into an act of doing and being together.
To build that space, we use sitting down on the floor, which is not mandatory for accessibility reasons. And we use shared rules, shared vocabulary, slowness and quietness, and a session of anonymous questions at the end of the tour.
The building of that space requires us to refuse working alone, seeking support from each other rather than a predetermined pedagogical structure. Working together helps to endure uncertainty and discomfort that rises from and is needed for an open-ended and unplanned situation. It also resists a pathological gaze on queer and creep perspectives and denies the diagnosis of deviancy. It leaves no space for harmful generalizations. As there is two of us in the guiding situation working from this particular intersection, the horizon of the other is opened up beyond the individual. By working together, we take ownership of that space and repurpose it to our own needs as a group. The building of that space requires us to refuse documenting our sessions with the camera, to challenge the notion of the visual as a proof, as it is evident that the space created is intangible and processual and cannot be captured.
The materials and the tours are constantly critically evaluated, developed and altered according to the feedback and discussions that we have during and after the tours. The feedback is gathered systematically through a form. And here we have some fragments of the feedback that we have been given. According to the general feedback, the tours are important because of the actual space they make for marginalized experience and existence in a museum and in a public space. The tours are informative and the tours are seen as informative and as open, equal and enabling space for learning. The tours are they are seen to balance the complicated issues and popular language, which is also an important accessibility point. The tours are regarded as a safer and calm space. The slowness and time are appreciated.
Yeah. The process of our work is open-ended, and we acknowledge our limitations and in answering the questions stated at the beginning. We have received a lot of positive feedback, but we have also been called out, and our limitations have been addressed. This keeps the process in movement and reminds us of our responsibility. We really appreciate any comments and feedback. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Apo and Yamina, for that fantastic discussion. Next we have Stephen Dryden.
Stephen will be presenting on the trans historical National Collections and Gender Non-Conformity. Now, I'll just give you a little bit of info. Stephen is the broadcast recordings curator at the British Library London. In 2017, he curated Gay UK, Love, Law and Liberty, an exhibition commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Sexual Offences Act in 1967. Stephen currently leads content development for the British Library LGBTQ Histories website. LGBTIQ in Australia. He has published several articles and in 2018 undertook a residency with the Women, Gender and Sexuality Department at Harvard University, working with students and giving to public lectures. So please welcome Stephen.
I guess first I'll just want to talk about the language for the title, and also that my talk doesn't explicitly deal with disability, though there are some links that we can make. So non-conformity in this instance, I'm using this term because gender in Mark 21 and RDA cataloguing standards, I'm a librarian, are either male or female. So at the moment there is actually no differentiation between people who identify outside of that binary, so hence using the term nonconformity here. I'm going to talk initially about how I became interested in the archive and finding non-conforming identities within it. And I work in a sound archive, so I'm going to be playing quite a lot of audio to you. So I tick box the sound portion of the title for this talk.
Striking midnight, and between now and about 5 a.m. I'm going to roam the streets, seeking out the kind of people that hover in the shadows, people we normally avoid. I admit I'm looking for the dramatic, but I hope that before morning I will have presented you with a picture of the night people in a typical city. Excuse me, I wonder if I might sit next to you and talk to you.
Yes, that's better.
What's he doing in the centre of Manchester?
I'm waiting for a boyfriend to come.
Boyfriend?
Yes, I'm a homosexual.
How do you feel about being a homosexual?
Well, it doesn't worry me. Personally, it just worries me about my family and, you know, the way the law is. I mean, I'm quite happy with the facts. It's other people that aren't.
So. You must encounter difficulties there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you try to get a job and things like that. But you get over them and you manage eventually.
What do you mean you say it's difficult when you try and get a job?
Well, I mean, people look at you and think, oh, he's one of those. Oh, they say, no, thank you. You see, well, I'm lucky where I am, where I work, because they don't mind. They know. And they don't mind.
But look, if you don't mind me saying so, you've got your hair dyed blonde.
Yeah.
You're wearing makeup.
Yeah.
You needn't be pointed out as one of those.
No. But, I mean, if I tried to hide it, then it'd mean I was ashamed of it, and I'm not. If I hid it, then it's admitting to myself that I shouldn't be what I am, when I want to say that I should be what I am, because that's how I was born.
To you, then, this is quite normal?
Yes, I mean, I've never been any other way as far as I can remember, and the normal way for me to act is the way I do.
I believe that you too are homosexual.
Yes.
But in fact, you differ from the man next to you because you're not wearing makeup.
Well, we both play the passive side, well, to put it bluntly. But with me living at home with my mother, and I've got younger brothers and sisters who are down most of the time, it's very hard for me to wear makeup and dress as a woman. So I do now and again.
Why?
Well, in man's clothing, I just can't, you know, one just can't feel comfortable. Whereas, as a woman, I know most people think you're exploiting yourself, but I feel more comfortable dressed as a woman than I do as a man.
What about the normal kind of lives that people lead, such as getting married and having children?
Well, I did at one time hope I could eventually get married, but to a man. See, signed myself on under the doctor, went to hospital and everything, but and then I just gave everything up as a bad job and I went abroad for a while.
So to me there was something quite interesting about these two people identifying as homosexuals, but then also there are gender non-conforming issues or identities going on there as well. There's also a mention of some kind of medical intervention which was considered at one point and then deciding not to do it. This material, The Night People, which is a recording from Manchester in 1966, isn't catalogued at all as having conversations with homosexuals included. It is simply catalogued as The Night People. And I listen to it because I like the title. So there are limits with the archive in terms of how it identifies this material in the first instance for researchers to find it.
Excuse me, Steph,
yes.
Can I just interrupt? If you are going to show more sound,
yeah.
We just need to fix something on the
That's
little
fine, let's
computer.
Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that
yeah. Yeah.
Stop the clock.
This is always an issue that you encounter working in the sound archive.
Yeah.
And leaving and going elsewhere, you have no control over the technology. mm-hmm.
I guess while I'm waiting, sorry.
Has it been transcribed at all?
I can transcribe and send it to you.
Yeah. Oh, no, I, that would be wonderful. But generally, just like in terms, so you, the only information you had is the title. So there's no transcription.
No,
like
I actually have been to the BBC's radio archive, since there's a written archive for the BBC in Caversham, which is Reading, just outside London. And the only paperwork that they have associated with this radio programme are the notes of the producers setting up the recording schedule. So there's no information about who these people are, what their names were. We only know that they recorded after midnight on the streets in Manchester. There's also, the next slide that I'm going to talk about, there are pieces of paper floating around with two newspaper articles. This is something that I encountered at the library through the use of technology. So these are newspaper articles. One, I believe, is from 1833, and the other is from 1901. So I found these newspaper articles using OCR, so optical character recognition, which basically means there's an algorithm running over a digitized image of a newspaper, finding words that you type into search, and pinging up results. So the articles there, the keywords that I was using were things like effeminate, effeminacy, man as woman, as a search term, women as men, and these are some of the examples of some of the results that came up.
Can we try towards the far end to play? Maybe just play the beginning of that one again.
And then I think if we can't get to work, we'll
I can share these files with anybody who's interested.
Ah. Cool. Great.
Okay.
The top, the tick tock, tick tock, tick tock.
Okay, start the clock. So these are also things that I became very conscious of after I had curated the exhibition at the library in 2017. I started also thinking about my responsibility as somebody working in a national institution and how I make things accessible or understandable to people. So Stuart Hall became a bit of a godsend to me in terms of finding him and starting to think about the library, the catalogue, and the metadata that is ascribed to objects as themselves objects and with power. I'm in a very privileged position that I have access to this material and have an understanding of how cataloguing works to be able to find it. So how best to share this material with the world outside and the communities of interest. So the newspaper articles that I've floated around, I was very interested in the people who were described in these articles. But I also didn't feel that it was my responsibility or my place to talk about the individuals in these articles. So I invited, with my newfound pedagogy of challenging power and holding the institution to account, decided to bring in three activists from the transgender community within London to look at these articles and then them tell us who these people were in the article themselves. Some really interesting things came up as a result of this. Things that I, as a cis queer male, would probably not have considered myself. So I'm going to play some audio from the recorded conversation that these three activists had at the library around the articles, and then I'll show you where you can access it so you could listen to the entire conversation. So, first issue around language.
That leads us back to this idea of identifying trans lives retrospectively. Mm-hmm. I actually feel like it is absolutely correct to do that when we're faced with evidence. This article, for example, outlines clearly that she had lovers, had always only ever been known as Eliza. Mm-hmm. Amongst you know, people who knew her in her professional world as well. She was a performer. So all of these things say that she lived her life as a woman and clearly identified. I don't know how to look back retrospectively without using the language I have.
Mm.
And I wonder about this argument that we can't say people were trans because it's a modern word. I wonder if that's not, again, part of a difficult, you know, leaning towards erasure.
Mm.
In actual fact, I don't see how I'm meant to understand the past if I don't use the terminology I know.
Yeah.
Mm. We're not scared of, I'm going to be controversial here, but we're not scared of using the word lesbian in the past, not scared of identifying gay lives in the past and gay subcultures. I wonder where this fear of the trans past, why it manifests even around our language, you know?
Mm.
So language is always, I think language is always political. It's always about who says what rather than what the words are themselves. You know, it may be, just to think about your controversial point, it may be in my mind great when trans people claim those people as trans, but maybe if they weren't trans, if they were institutes, or I don't know, maybe we'd have a different viewpoint. I'm just, yeah, kind of wondering that. And I think also the thing about trans, a little bit like lesbian as well, or gay, is that
I didn't mean to make such a crass comparison.
But I think there is slippage, and I enjoy that slippage between gender and sexuality, or LGB and T. And it could be that, you know, could we describe this person as queer or as gay, you know, as homosexual, like? Because, as you know, and there are other words as well, aren't there, like maybe in Victorian times, like invert or other words.
Mm.
And I think we shouldn't discount those things as well, and use the opportunity to open up how we might consider these people. If that brings us back
several
to this
different
idea.
Stages.
Oh no. So, sorry, there you hear a conversation which has come about by activists looking at this material and then interpreting it for us and for themselves, for their community. Some really interesting things come up which I obviously wouldn't have thought of, so I'm going to jump straight to this community clip that I've cut from the conversation.
And they had several different stages of talk about how we're going to expose this body that we've found with its extraordinary circumstances, and ways of trying to find the next level of people who need to get involved in just a dead woman, as we've read of.
Yes. Mm. I think it also resonates with the personal fear I have of dying with dignity.
Mm.
And I don't hear a lot of talk about that in even within trans circles and trans communities. We're just growing up in the public insofar as tackling social oppression that we do face already. So key things that do come on the agenda might be education, for example, and the incredible work GI does. Things that we're not quite up to yet, I feel like dying with dignity is one of them.
I would definitely agree with that. I think there is some thinking, because we know we've got an older population, a growing older population, and so what does that community look like? And I think there are organisations that are thinking about LGBT people, but I think even being trans in those services is challenging. And certainly, I would say, being a trans person, an older trans person who is looked after by carers, would make me feel quite comfortable in terms of what do they understand about, and how can they be respectful of my trans identity, my body, and my relationship to my body.
So in this respect, this is why I quite like the term trans historical, because this is an object from the past which is informing a conversation which is very current and very relevant in the community who are engaging with the historical object. And I think that non-conforming gender identities, using technical terminology that as a librarian we could use, this is a really interesting term and idea, I think, for how we approach the archive. So this conversation, which was between E.J. Scott, who spoke earlier at the conference here in Berlin, who is a wonderful activist and individual, Dr. Jay Stewart from Gendered Intelligence, and Annie Brown. You can listen to this entire conversation on the British Library LGBTQ Histories website. It's a 40-minute conversation, and I'm very happy to say that in the last 9 months, it's been accessed over 2,000 times, the full conversation. The actual article itself is the second most popular of the articles on this website. So there's obviously a desire for this kind of content, or there is an engagement with this kind of content of considering the trans historical, the gender non-binary identities in the past. This is also informing work that I'm continuing to do in communities. So this is a catalogue entry for collection material from the India office. In case you don't know, Britain has a very terrible colonial and empire building past. We do. And this is a record from the India office archive. So this is the office which managed the colonial empires of India, which is deposited at the British Library. And this is the catalogue entry. Appointment required. Please consult Asian and African Studies print room staff. There are levels of entry into this collection, this document, which is a census from Marwa, which is a province in northern India. I was really intrigued by this item because I was interested in identities that I might find inside them. And sure enough, inside the object itself were the inclusion of the Hijra, which is a third gender within Indian society. This is a census document, so obviously this is the colonial powers making records of who is in which province and categorising them, very much like a library would. So we can see here that the Hijra, also spelt Hijra, which today we would just use the term Hijra, so again there is a language issue here, how we might identify or find this even with optical character recognition. And then also bringing in disability, perhaps, or how sexuality and gender might be linked to disability historically. The Hijra are classed as eunuchs in this chart, coming together with the blind, the insane, and lepers. So this is how the colonial powers in India in this period were viewing the Hijra. So in order for the library to best explore this material, my opinion is, and we're in the process of doing it, is to bring into the library, like we have in, with EJ, Jay and Annie, activists from the non-binary trans community from the Indian subcontinent to talk about these objects. We also have other photographs of the Hijra which were taken for census gathering reasons, and let them interpret the material. And I hope personally that that will bring up lots of issues around colonialism, empire building, and why these documents are in the British Library, and also how we make them accessible for researchers now. And I'll leave it there. I'm happy to talk about other things that we're doing as well, but.
Thank you, Stephen.
Yep.
So that's fantastic. We've got heaps of time for questions and discussion. So is there anyone here with a question?
Hi. Thank you, everyone, for the presentation. I have a question for Apo and Yamina. Thanks very much for that presentation. I'm also an artist and sometimes pedagogue who works with guided tours that queer museum exhibitions. And I really appreciated your sort of overview of the different theoretical underpinnings of the work you're doing and some of the principles that you base your work on. And while I also respect that you don't want to photograph the work you do, I really appreciated the idea of not using the visual as proof. I found myself really wishing that I could find out more about what actually happens on these tours. And I wondered if you could maybe give an example of maybe an encounter with a specific photograph or artwork and what kinds of gaze exercises, sort of really just to be able to imagine it a little bit more clearly. I'm really curious.
Yeah, so we basically start off by sitting on the floor or taking the space and making it calm, and then we kind of discuss with the visitors that who they are and what are they expecting, and then we start the conversation from there, what they were not
And then we have like three posts during the 1.5 hours.
Yeah.
And those are a specific series of photographs or one photograph.
Yeah. And then we do readings, us, and then the exercise can be, it differs very much depending on the group. But it can be very simple, like kind of using these kind of tiny frames.
Yeah.
To frame a photo or a picture and talk about the feelings that the image or the detail evokes, and then start from there. But it's so like discussion based, so it's very hard to like, concretely tell what happened.
But the reading exercise, the gazing exercise, can be that we are saying that now we are coming to this and this series, and we don't really talk that much about the. Like the artist's intents of the photographs, that we say that it, what it's like greatly about, and then perhaps say that if something catches your eye, you can like frame it with this, and then those who want to share what caught their eye, and maybe like why, then they share, and we discuss from there.
So it's sort of a method that you can apply to any artwork in the collection.
Yeah.
But do you change the artwork each time you do the tour, or are there set artworks that you've selected that you feel are especially kind of ripe for queering and cripping?
It depends on the exhibitions, because sometimes it's very hard to like, the content of the exhibition is not like directly about these issues,
right.
So it depends. But we like select 1, 2, 3 posts, but also it changes, with every exhibition it's different.
Yeah, and sometimes there are like so explicit contents of these issues that we kind of want to, but they kind of draw everyone to there.
Sure.
Yeah, so it depends on that.
And sometimes there's none.
Yeah.
Is some of that outlined more in the booklet? You showed a kind of booklet that was online, sort of early in your...
Yeah, it's this week.
But it's mainly about their thesis projects?
Yeah, this is not... It's kind of like how this started. This.
Yeah.
It's pink and it glitters.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's like our individual practices more mainly in that book, and how we now we are combining them. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Another question?
So going off of that, because I had those questions as well, if you don't have documentation, can they follow along with any kind of physical object, or is it purely discussion, and like they don't have any kind of brochure or pamphlet bringing them around, or?
No, it's, we have like, we give them, like paper and how do you say it?
Like
means to take notes themselves. And then we have this vocabulary list, which we always add on when people are saying that something is
explained. Be added or explained, or when we get called out that this is not here, it should be here, then we're like always making a new vocabulary for every session.
Yeah, so it kind of accumulates. So that's what they have, and we kind of like, we use a lot of social interaction and like, conversational, I don't know how to explain. Like it's like even the sitting down somehow starts the thing.
But it always happens as a group tour. If you're asking if there's sort of a document that people can do it themselves.
No.
But what we are left with is the feedback and the post-it from the anonymous question session that is in the end. So that's like the thing that is left behind.
Do you have a question?
I also have a question to you two. I also work in arts education, so a lot of what you said really resonated with me in my practice and discussions I have with other people in Berlin. And I wanted to ask about, because you mentioned that you always work as a group of two together, and I was interested in how did you negotiate your working conditions with the institution? Because, for example, like guided tours are sometimes part of marketing departments in Germany. They're not part of the education department.
Yeah.
So that creates their own challenges. So the idea of two people doing what one person can would just be counterproductive for them.
Yeah.
And also it's a challenge working in arts education in some of the German institutions as far as resources. So I'm interested in
have you created your working conditions?
Well, by negotiating. Asked us, like, commissioned us to do this, and we were like, okay, we can do this, but we are not doing it alone. And if you want this, you take both of us, like, together all the time.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, like...
It wasn't evident that
it was about to happen.
Yeah.
We had to explain ourselves, and because we were kind of like, how do you say, encountering attitudes that do you want to make it easier for yourselves?
Yeah.
And we had to explain that it's not going to happen, like this intersection is not going to be there. We are not negotiating in front of everyone and with everyone.
Yeah. So this is also unusual, like in the arts education.
Yeah, it is.
I kind of building off the kind of question of compensation for Ava and Stephen, I was struck thinking about, I was curious to know, especially in the context of like the British Library, where so many things come out of processes of violent extraction, when you have these interviews, are you able to compensate the people who are sharing their knowledge to kind of avoid further kind of extractive relations that often like mark British institutions? So there's just a kind of a general question, and also like kind of how, as an archivist, do you think about like as you add things to the collection in the British Library, in the kind of, because the British Library has that massive oral history project,
mm-hmm.
and the relation of power. And it struck me as I was thinking about that question that with Eva's presentation, there are so many questions of like how your kind of unpaid labor and is can be. And it's your unpaid labor and its relationship to institutions, and like how, what kind of forms of support can you access while also maintaining the autonomy that you were like so beautifully described that produced these vast archives. So maybe it's a bit messy, but kind of thinking also about kind of how people get paid in all this context.
The article that I played clips of the audio from, Annie, Jay and Stuart were paid a fee to take part in that conversation. In terms of, and the contributors to this conversation around India Office collection material will also be paid a fee for their time and travel expenses. But in terms of retrospectively going back, if you're talking about
I was specifically curious, but then kind of broadly how... Because there's like a lot. I mean, this is not the only collection.
Do you want to know how it's funded, or I mean, I don't.
No, just more like an ethical question about like how you relate to like you know this like with this image.
Yeah.
Like we can imagine the kind of uneven circumstances that produce that image that has like an incredible social value today.
Yeah.
But then is sitting in either London or Bath, like waiting to be viewed, and you know, and just how that relates also. Because I see there's a lot of relationship between making those decisions to pay those contributors today and then negotiating access to images like this.
This image is out of copyright, so it's copyright free. When it goes online in the article, it will be free for anybody to use. In fact, this image is actually already floating around in the World Wide Web because it's already been digitized as part of a project. So provided it's out of copyright, and we don't know any copyright holders, and indeed this image, we don't know who took this photograph, we don't know who the individuals are who are in it, we just know that they were in the Marwa province in 1891-ish, late 1800s, 1880s, when the census was done. So it's a really interesting question. The British Library as a whole has an ongoing process of... talking about its historic holdings, we have lots of problematic collection material. We used to be part of the British Museum. We all probably know about the Elgin Marbles and all of that. So we do actually have an ongoing discussion about repatriation and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. I have a full-time job at the Helsinki University Library, but my work has nothing to do with my activism. But last year, I got, I was named a good worker. I got €2,000 as from my employer to recognize my work, and I spent it with the professional scanner. But the mailing this stuff, I have another workshop at the Finnish Pain Legal. It is about it, and it makes sure it's online. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, Stephen, I'm curious about, I'm an artist and a grassroots archivist, and I work a lot with audio. and I, you know, talking to people here, and also in the world, I think it's not something that I find, it's a slippery thing to work with, and not something that folks are always gravitating towards. So can you talk about your choice to, and I'm struck by the fact that you're documenting these conversations via audio. I don't know if there's video somewhere that I just would see, but, and there's reasons why I work in that way, but I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about your choice to document using audio and your interest in audio and kind of spoken conversation.
Cool. That's a long conversation. I'm really happy to chat about it after. But in brief, I've always worked with sound as a kind of medium. Even as a teenager, I worked at record shops. When I went to university, I gravitated towards the fine art department and documented performance and live art. Sound itself, I think there's something very intimate just about hearing a voice rather than looking at an image, a moving image. And the reason why I decided not to video the conversation that was happening with EJ, Annie, and Jay was purely logistical in this instance. I would have had to have gotten loads of different kinds of permissions to film within the conservation studios at the library, where I was able to have the objects out on show in the room for the activists to talk with them there. But also, I think there's something quite nice of just about listening. I think you pay more attention and concentrate a bit more with just audio, personally. But I'm very happy to talk at length about soundy stuff over a coffee.
Question.
Yeah.
I have a question for Eva. Thank you for sharing this really personal journey. I don't know the right word. To hear your story made me think of that as an archive, saying just come and donate is not enough. Even if the archives often don't have the resources to work in another way. I thought, would you be interested in working with somebody for over a longer period? Would your material, somebody who helps you to, you know, remember and work with you on the metadata, is this something you would be interested in? And to talk about this, all these like questions and concerns you have about the material and about the protection of these really sensitive information.
I am not very sure. It takes a lot of time to go through the materials. It is not easy. But you can contact me and we can talk about it. You can just try to talk with me. I am too busy at work, and I have very little time for this year.
Thank you, Eva. Did you have a question?
Yeah. As well as Stephen. So thank you, that was amazing. I'm very impressed what you're doing. I was just wondering if you could sort of speak a bit more about how you might be using the kind of information gained from these conversations with activists and this type of stuff that you're finding through your knowledge of how kind of catalogs work. How we could speak a bit more about how it might translate into how you're going to be cataloging things in future or re-cataloging what you already have, so it's easier for other people to kind of find this information or find these kind of documents.
Yeah, I'm very happy to talk about that. So the British Library has a very big project at the moment called Unlocking Our Sound Heritage, which is a digitization project of many of our audio carriers. This is more for conservation reasons, because we're worried about physical obsolescence of players to be able to play the audio rather than the audio itself. As a result of that, we are encountering gender non-conforming individuals, but also in our current archiving, we archive, the BBC have a radio programme called The Listening Project, which is where two individuals will get together and have a conversation who usually know each other. And we have ongoing oral history projects, which are constantly being added to. And the issue of gender non-conforming individuals or identities, gender non-binary identities, is becoming more and more prevalent in current archiving, in current recordings which are being archived. As a result of that, and the work that I've done, myself, Charlie Morgan, who is an archivist in the oral history department, and Holly Gilbert, who is an archivist in the sociolinguistics department, have created a document where we hope to change RDA standards, so that's the cataloguing standards that librarians use, for sound recordings in the first instance, to allow for something other than male and female to be used as a gender identity. That's a big negotiation because that's an international standard. Mm-hmm. So we've started the conversation by producing a document with evidence about why we think it's necessary. We're in the process of sharing that with various institutions, organisations who have a vested interest or are perhaps already engaging in similar projects. There's some amazing work going on in Canada at the moment. We've been engaging with them, and also the Oral History Society. They have an LGBTQI special interest group who we've asked for feedback from. We hope in the next 6 months we'll be able to share that with colleagues at the Library of Congress. We want to make sure we've got lots of capital behind us before we approach the Library of Congress, and then we can start maybe formalising how we can institute this for sound recordings. But then hopefully that might migrate into print cataloguing as well, which would be ideal. Awesome. Obviously, in retrospect, going back historically and doing this is a minefield. We are very much focusing on current acquisition, so things coming in where people are identifying in a specific way with specific terms. Mm-hmm. I personally would be very reluctant to identify the individuals captured in this photograph in any way, shape or form. I think it's giving people the language and the terminology to perhaps interpret what is in this image is my responsibility as a librarian, the information science. But I wouldn't say how these people identify or anything like that. That starts getting tricky, I think. I think that's the job of researchers and academics.
Stephen.
Yeah, I was wondering, and also for you, I'm wondering also as an artist and one who doesn't do finished researches or anyhow objective something, academic something, I'm doing also that perspective from which I'm asking, is it really necessary to have the overall of all the books really scanned and prepared, or what? And is it maybe possible to also zoom in into parts, because this potential I can feel is so rich that I wonder if there are many details that can be worked on already more. I imagine it as a huge zoom in into some parts only, parts that maybe people would be okay with working on, or you would be okay with sharing. Not the embarrassing teenager conversation that I imagine them to have partly. So, is there maybe a fragmented way to approach a more unfinished one, a really personal one? Because that is what I find really intriguing, and also, what I'm personally working on, this non-linearity of telling the history and the open questions that are more rich than the answers. So maybe I don't know.
Partly, I think there's just too much. I scanned one book last week and it was and his faces. Very difficult to read badly. There are other books that I think are from conferences and activists that go to international conferences, they could be more motivated to share the material. But how to contact them? Many have dropped out of activism or retired, and it would be a big job to try to contact them. It is too much work, simply.
Any other questions? Do any of the panelists have any questions for each other?
I'm not sure if it might work or not, but the digital scanning and the OCR technology that I used to find the newspapers might perhaps help in the cataloging and metadata generation for your conversation books, maybe. Maybe.
Maybe. But I do not think that Finnish archives would use it.
Mm.
The resources are lacking.
Yeah. Resourcing is a huge issue. Mm.
Any other questions or comments? Fantastic. Thank you so much to the presenters here. Can you give them a good round of applause?